expect that for months. It was not a surprise. Your mother and I wanted you very much, even before you began to exist. What I didn't know to expect is that today, I would feel like I'd been born too. You have made me a new person, January's father. And I know this is who I will be for the rest of my life. I'm looking at you now, January, as I'm writing this, and I can barely get the words onto the page. I am in shock, January. I didn't know I could be this person. I didn't know I could feel all this. I can't believe someday you will wear a backpack, know how to hold a pencil, have opinions on how you like to wear your hair. I'm looking at you and I can't believe you are going to become more amazing than you already are. 10 fingers, 10 toes, and even if you had none of them, you'd still be the grandest thing I've ever seen. I can't explain it. Do you feel it? Now that you're old enough to read this and to know who you are, do you have a word for the thing that evades me? The thing that makes you different from anything else? I guess I should tell you something about myself, about who I am at this very moment as I watch you sleep on your mother's chest. Well, nice to meet you, January. I'm your father, the man you made from nothing but your tiny fingers and toes. One for every year, always written on the day. January, today you are one. Who am I today, January? I'm the hand that guides you while you take your clumsy steps. Today, your mother and I made spaghetti, so I guess you could say I'm a chef, too. Your personal one. I never used to like to cook much, but it has to be done. Happy second birthday, January. Your hair has gotten so much darker. You wouldn't remember being a blonde, would you? I like it more this way. It suits you very much. Your mother says you look like her grandmother, but I think you take after my mother. She would have loved you. I'll try to tell you a bit about her, too. She was from a place called North Bear Shores. That's where I'm from, too. I lived there when I was your age. I was a nasty 2-year-old, she used to tell me. I guess I screamed until I passed out. But that was probably at least in part due to Randy, my oldest brother, a bit of a jackass, but a lovable one. He lives in Hong Kong now, because he is fancy. January, I can't believe you're 4. You are person-shaped now. I suppose you always were, but you're more so now than ever. When I was 4, I wrecked my tricycle. I was riding down a pier toward the lighthouse at the end. My mother had gotten distracted by a friend, and I thought it would be neat to ride right off the pier, see if I was going fast enough to stay atop the water, like Roadrunner. She saw me at the last minute and screamed my name. When I turned to look at her, I yanked the handlebars and smashed into the lighthouse itself. That's how I got that big pink scar on my elbow. I suppose it isn't so big now, or else my elbow is quite a bit bigger. Last week you cracked your head on the fireplace. It wasn't too bad, didn't even need stitches, but your mother and I cried all night after you'd gone to sleep. We felt so bad. Sometimes, January, being a parent feels like being a kid who someone has mistakenly handed another kid. Good luck, this unwise stranger cries before turning his back on you forever. We will always make mistakes, I'm afraid. I hope they will get smaller and smaller as we get bigger and bigger. Older, really. We're rather done growing. 8. 8 years old and smart as a whip. You never stop reading, January. I hated reading when I was 8, but then again, I was terrible at it, and both Randy and Douglas used to tease me mercilessly, though these days Douglas is as gentle as a butterfly. I imagine if I'd been better at reading, I would have liked it more. Or maybe vice versa. My dad was a busy man, but he was the one who taught me how to read, January. And since he'd started, I wouldn't let my poor mother have anything to do with it. Well, when the time comes, I'm teaching you to drive, she used to tell me. Your favorite book right now is The Giving Tree. But God, January, that book breaks my heart. Your mother is a bit like that tree. And I worry you will be too. Don't get me wrong, that's a good way to be. But still, I wish you could be a bit stonier, like your old pop. Only for your own good. You know, when I was 8, I shoplifted for the first time. Not condoning it, of course, but the goal of this is honesty. I stole gum from the old-fashioned candy store on the main drag in North Bear Shores. I loved that shop. They had these great big fans to keep the chocolate from melting in the summer, and on days when my mother was occupied, my brothers and I would stroll down there to get out of the heat. I never found it much fun to go to the beach on my own. Perhaps now I'd feel different. I haven't been in a while. Your mother and I have been talking about taking you soon. January, you were 13 and braver than any 13-year-old should have to be. Today, I don't know who I am. I am your father still, of course, and the husband of your mother. But January, sometimes life is very hard. Sometimes it demands so much of you that you start losing pieces of yourself as you stretch out to give what the world wants to take. I'm lost, January. Remember that lighthouse I told you about? I think I told you about it. Sometimes I think about you as that lighthouse. Keep your eyes on January, I tell myself. She won't lead you astray. If you focus on January, you won't go too far off course. But maybe I was so focused I ran smack dab into you. Your mother, too. I know this year has been frightening for you, but please know that some way or another, your mother and I are going to find our way back to ourselves and back to each other. Please don't be afraid, my sweet baby, my daring pirate queen of the open seas. Somehow everything will be okay. I got my first kiss when I was 16, January. Her name was Sonia, and she was stringy and serene. Your birthday isn't for a few more months, but I have to write this now. Today, you are leaving for college, January, and I'm afraid it might kill me. Of course, I can't tell you that. You would feel so guilty, and you shouldn't. You are, by all accounts, doing the right thing. You have always been so smart. This is where you belong, and it's not forever. But when you wake up this morning and we start driving north, I won't be looking at you in the rearview mirror. And when you read this, when will that be? Think back to that day. Will you even notice that I can't look at you? Probably not. You're so nervous yourself. But if you do remember, now you'll know why. I worry I might turn around and drive the three of us back home if you show any ounce of hesitation. I want to keep you forever. Who am I without you? You should be in graduate school, and we all know it. Fuck cancer, January. You're an adult now, so that means by the time you read this, you should be well acquainted with the word fuck, and we both know you're already too closely acquainted with the word cancer. Well, fuck it. I have to be honest, January. I feel like our lives are imploding, and a part of me wants to shove you far, far away until the implosion stops. I told you I'd be honest with you, so here it is. If I write it here, I know I will not be able to take it back. Someday you will read this. Someday you will know. I am cheating on your mother. Sometimes I feel like I am comforting myself, and other times it feels like a punishment. Still other days I wonder if it's all a big F you to the universe. If you want to destroy my life, I can destroy it worse. Some days I think I am in love with Sonia. Sonia, that's her name. I was in love with her once when we were kids. I think I told you in your 16th birthday letter. That was the year I kissed her. I'm sure you don't want to hear that, but I think I need to say it. I'm in love with a version of myself that can't exist in this hell. Do you think I'm terrible, January? It's okay if you do. I have been terrible at many different moments in my life. I want to go back to being the man your mother made me, her new husband, the man you made me, your adoring father. I'm searching for something of myself I lost, and it's not fair to anyone. If I could have the past back, those beautiful years before the cancer came back, I would pounce. I'm going to fix this. Don't give up on me, January. It isn't the end. January, today you are 28. When I was 28, my beautiful wife gave birth to our child. On this day, January 13th, widely regarded as the best day in the history of days, sometimes I think about what your children would look like. Not your and Jacques specifically, though that would be fine too. I picture a girl who looks like January. Maybe she has 10 fingers and 10 toes, but even if she doesn't, she will be perfect. And I think about the kind of woman you will be for her, the kind of mother. When I think about this January, I usually cry, because I know you will do better than I did, and I am so relieved by that thought. But even if you don't, even if you make the kinds of mistakes I made, I know you, January. I know you so much better than you know me, and I'm sorry, but if there had to be an imbalance, I can't say I regret it going this way. Remember your first breakup? I mentioned it in the letter for your 17th birthday. You were devastated. Your mother called into your job at Taco Bell and pretended to be you, too sick to come in. In that moment, I was so in love with her. She knew just what to do. The way she took care of you, there are no words. She knows, by the way, she knows everything I've told you. She's let me take my time telling you. I worry she's ashamed, that she thinks everyone will pity her, and you know how she hates that. She's not sure you need to know. Maybe you don't. If that's the case, I'm sorry. But I guess I wanted you to see the whole truth so you would know. If you think the story has a sad ending, it's because it's not over yet. Since I started these letters, I've been a million different things, some good and some ugly. But today, on your 28th birthday, I feel like the same man I was all those years ago. Staring at you, counting your fingers, wondering what it is that makes you so different from the rest of the world. I don't know when it happened, but I'm happy again. I think, even if things don't stay like this, I will always carry this moment in me. How could I ever be sad, having watched my baby grow into the woman she is? January, you are 28, and today, I am your father. Chapter 26. The Best Friend. I lay back on the floor and stared up at the stars. Fluffy, dark clouds were drifting across the sky, blotting them out bit by bit, and I was watching them like a countdown, though to what I didn't know. The letters lay in a heap around me, all unfolded, all read. 2 hours hadn't given me closure, but it was time I'd never expected to have with him. Words he hadn't said to me finally spoken. I felt like I had time traveled. I was a wound, half healed over and scraped raw again. Everybody hurts was running through my mind. I could see the consolation of it, the idea that your pain wasn't unique. Something about that made it seem both bigger and smaller. Smaller because all the world was aching. Bigger because I could finally admit that every other feeling I'd been focusing on had been a distraction from the deepest hurt. My father was gone, and I would always miss him. And that had to be okay. I reached for my phone and opened the YouTube app. I typed "Everybody Hurts," and I played it there from my phone speakers. When it ended, I started it over. The pain settled into a deep rhythm. It felt almost like exercising, a mounting burn through my muscles and joints. Once, in a bad season of tension headaches, my doctor had told me that pain was our body demanding to be heard. Sometimes it's a warning, she said. Sometimes it's a billboard. I didn't know what this pain's intent was, but I thought, if I listen to it, maybe it will be content to close back up for a while. Maybe this night of pain would give me even a day of relief. The song ended. I started it over. The night was cold. I wondered how much colder it would be in January. I wanted to see it. If I did, I thought. That would be one more part of him I could meet. I gathered the letters and envelopes into a neat stack and stood to go home. But now, when I pictured the house on the edge of the lake, a strange new variation of that searing ache, Gus in D minor, I thought, passed through me. I felt like I was coming apart, like the connective tissue between my left and right ribs had been hacked away and I was going to split. It had been hours now since we'd parted. I'd gotten no call, not even a text. I thought about the look on his face when he'd seen Naomi, like a ghost was standing in front of his eyes. A tiny, beautiful ghost he had once loved so madly he'd married her. So madly he wanted to work through it when she tore his heart to pieces. I started to cry again, so hard I couldn't see. I opened my texts with Shoddy and typed, "I need you." It was seconds before she answered, "First train out." I stared at my phone for a second longer. There was only one other person I really wanted to talk to now. I tapped the contact info and held the phone to my ear. It was the middle of the night. I didn't expect an answer, but on the second ring, the line clicked on.
"Janie?"
Mom whispered in a rush.
"Are you okay?"
"No,"
I squeaked.
"Tell me, honey,"
she urged. I could hear her sitting up, the rustle of sheets drawing back, and the faint click of her bedside lamp turning on.
"I'm here now, honey. Just tell me everything."
My voice wrenched upward as I started at the beginning.
"Did I tell you Jock broke up with me in a hot tub?"
Mom gasped.
"That little shit weasel."
And then I told her the rest. I told her everything. Shoddy arrived at 10 a.m. with a duffel bag an NBA player could have slept comfortably in and a box of fresh produce. When I opened the door to find her on the sunlit porch, I leaned first to see into the cardboard box and asked, "No booze?"
"Did you know you have an amazing farmer's market 2 blocks from here?" she said, whisking inside.
"And that the only Uber driver seems to be legally blind?" I tried to laugh, but just the sight of her here had tears welling up behind my eyes.
"Oh, honey,"
Shoddy said, and set the box down on the couch before enveloping me in a hug that was all rose water and coconut oil.
"I'm so sorry,"
she said, her hand toying in my hair in a gentle, motherly way. She pulled back and gripped my arms, examining me.
"The good news is," she said softly, "your skin looks like a newborn baby's. What have you been eating out here?"
I tipped my head toward the box of squash and greenery.
"None of that."
"Drafting diet?" she hazarded, and when I nodded, she patted my arm and turned toward the kitchen, gathering the box in her arms as she went.
"I figured as much. Before the booze and the crying, you need a vegetable, and probably like eggs or something."
She stopped short as she reached the kitchen, gasping either at size, scope, and style, or at the disgusting mess I'd managed to make of it.
"Okay,"
she said, regrouping as she began to unload the veggies on the lone spare bit of countertop.
"How about you change out of those pants, and I'll start on brunch?"
"What's wrong with these pants?"
I gestured to my sweats.
"These are my official uniform now, on account of I've officially given up."
Shoddy rolled her eyes and drummed her blue nails on the counter.
"Honestly, Janie, it doesn't have to be a ball gown, but I will not cook for you until you put on pants that involve a button or zipper."
My stomach grumbled then, as if pleading with me, and I turned back to the first floor bedroom. There were a handful of wrinkled t-shirts Gus had discarded in the past couple of weeks on the floor, never to be picked up again, and I kicked them into a pile behind the closet door where I wouldn't have to look at them, then dressed in cutoffs and an Ella Fitzgerald t-shirt. Making brunch was an hour and a half long affair, and then there was the fact that Shoddy insisted we finish all the dishes before we took a bite.
"Look at this stack," I reasoned with her, gesturing at the leaning pile of cereal-crusted bowls. "It could be Christmas by the time we've gotten through all of these."
"Then I'm glad I packed a coat," Shoddy replied with a casual shrug. In the end, it only took half an hour to load the dishwasher and hand wash everything that didn't fit.
When we'd finished eating, Shadi insisted on cleaning the entire house. All I really wanted to do was lie on the couch, eating a pile of potato chips off my chest and watching reality TV, but it turned out she was right. Cleaning was a much better distraction. For once, I didn't think about Dad's lies or Sonia approaching me at the funeral. I didn't replay tidbits of my fight in the car with Mom or picture the pretty, apologetic smile on Naomi's full lips. I didn't worry about the book or what Anya would think or what Sandy would do. I didn't really think at all. Deep cleaning put me into a trance. I wished I could stay in an emotional cryogenic chamber that would allow me to sleep through the worst of whatever heartbreak I was avoiding. The first phone call from Gus had come at about 11, and I didn't answer. There wasn't another for 20 minutes, and when that one finally came in, making my heart knot up into my throat, he left no voicemail and sent no follow-up texts. I turned my phone off and stuck it in the dresser drawer in my bedroom, then went back to mopping the bathroom. Shadi and I decided not to talk about it, about SEG or the haunted hat or anything else, until we'd finished with our work, which seemed like a good policy, since the cleaning was helping to numb me, and any time my brain even gestured toward a thought about Gus, the numbness started to unravel from my middle. At 6, Shadi determined we were done and banished me to the shower while she started on dinner. She made ratatouille, which she'd apparently been craving ever since she watched the movie Ratatouille with Ricky's little sisters during 4th of July weekend. "You can tell me about him," I promised, as we sat on either side of the table, my back turned to the window into Gus's house, despite the fact that it and its blinds were both closed. "I still want to hear about you being happy." "After dinner," Shadi said. And again, she was right. It turned out I needed this, another meal comprised mostly of vegetables, with nothing but comfortable small talk. Things we'd seen our old classmates post online, books she'd been reading, shows I'd been watching, only Veronica Mars. After dinner, the sky clouded over, and as I was washing our plates and silverware, and Shadi was making us Sazeracs, it began to rain heartily, claps of distant thunder quivering through the house like mini earthquakes. When I dried the serving dish and put it away in the cupboard to the right of the oven, she handed me my glass and we went to the couch I'd spent my first night on and curled up in opposite corners, our feet tucked under a blanket together. "Now," she said, "start at the beginning." Chapter 27. The Rain. We talked all night, through the storms that rolled in and out like waves, always carrying a fresh batch of thunder and lightning in just when it seemed like it might let up. Our conversation took that long, with all the breaks for crying and the two Shadi took to make us fresh drinks. In the time we'd been friends, I'd witnessed 5 of Shadi's life-shattering breakups. "It's about time you threw me a bone," she assured me. "I needed you to cry this much so I can come to you if and when Ricky destroys me."
"Is he going to?" I asked through sniffles, and Shadi let out a deep sigh. "Almost definitely."
She had a habit of falling in love with people who had no interest in falling in love. It always started as something casual, a fling that accidentally put down roots. In the end, there was always something standing in the way, something that had been there from the very beginning, but hadn't been an issue back when things had been truly casual. There was the pillhead cook, the alcoholic skateboarder, the extremely promising mentor in an after-school program for disadvantaged youth who, ultimately, had told Shadi he loved her in the same breath he'd admitted he wanted to be single for a few more years. Everything about my best friend was misleading to the men of Chicago. She was eccentric and loud, prone to heavy drinking and all-night partying, comfortable with casual hookups, always the funniest and most shocking person in any room, and she posted mostly nude selfies with increasing regularity. She was enigmatic, the closest to the stereotypical male fantasy I'd ever seen outside of a movie. But deep down, she was completely aromantic. When she connected with someone, she opened up like a rose to expose the most tender, pure, selfless, and loyal heart I'd ever known. And when the men children she accidentally wound up dating saw that side of her, they often wound up ass over toes in love with her, as she did with them, dreaming of a future that neither of them had signed up for at the start of it all. "I wish there was literally anything I could do to stop it," she said then. "No, you don't," I teased, and a slow smile spread across her face. "I both love and despise falling in love." "Same," I said. "Men are the worst." "The worst," she sang. For a few seconds, we were silent. The tears on my cheeks had dried, and the sun had started to rise, but the storm clouds were blocking it, diffusing the strange bluish light that came through the blinds across the couch. "Hey," she said finally. "I think it was time."
"What was?"
I asked. "I think it was time for you to fall in love," she said. "All this time I've known you and I've never gotten to see it. I think it was time."
"You knew me before Jacques. You watched that happen."
"Yeah." Shadi gave a shrug. "I know you loved Jacques. And maybe in the end it's the same thing you wind up with, but with him, you never fell, Janie. You marched straight in."
"So falling's the part that hurts?" I asked with a humorless laugh.
"And if you wind up in love without it hurting, then there's no falling?"
"No,"
Shadi said seriously. "Falling's the part that takes your breath away. It's the part when you can't believe the person standing in front of you both exists and happened to wander into your path. It's supposed to make you feel lucky to be alive, exactly when and where you are."
Tears clouded my vision. I did feel that with Gus, but I'd felt it once before. "You're wrong that you never saw that with me," I said. And Shadi cocked her head thoughtfully. "That's how I felt when I found you."
A smile broke across her face, and she tossed one of the couch cushions at me.
"I love you, Janie," she told me. "I love you more."
After a moment, her smile faded, and she gave one frank shake of her head.
"I'm sure he loves you too," she said. "I can feel it." "You haven't even seen us together," I pointed out. "You haven't even really met him."
"I can feel it." She waved a hand toward the wall just as another thunderous rumble shook the house, lightning slashing across the windows.
"Wafting off his house. Also, I'm psychic."
"So there's that," I said.
"Right," Shadi said.
"So there's that." It might have been seconds between the moment I finally drifted to sleep on the couch and the one when the pounding on the door began. Or it might have been hours. The living room was still masked in stormy shadows, and thunder was still shivering through the floorboards. Shadi shot upright at the far end of the couch and clutched the blanket to her chest, her green eyes going wide at the second round of pounding. She hissed through the dark,
"Are we being axe murdered?"
Then I heard his voice coming through the door.
"January."
Shadi scooted back against the arm of the couch.
"That's him, isn't it?"
He pounded again, and I stood, unsure what I was doing, what I should do, what I wanted to do. I looked at Shadi, silently asking her these questions. She shrugged as another knock sounded.
"Please," Gus said. "Please, January, I won't keep asking if you don't want me to, but please talk to me."
He fell silent, and the whine of the wind stretched out like an ellipsis begging to add more. My throat felt like it had collapsed, like I needed to swallow down the rubble a few times before I could get the words out.
"What would you do?"
I asked Shadi. She let out a long breath.
"You know what I would do, Janie."
She'd said it last night. I wish there was literally anything I could do to stop it. The joke being that of course there was something she could do to stop it, and yet somehow she could never bring herself to let the text messages and phone calls go unanswered. No way she could convince herself not to visit a new lover's family for a national holiday. No chance she could give up on the possibility of love. I couldn't know what Gus was going to tell me about last night, about Naomi, or where we stood. I couldn't know, but I could survive it. I thought back to that moment in the car when I tried to carve the memory into my mind so that if and when I looked back on everything, I could tell myself it had been worth it. that for a few weeks, I had been happier than I had all year. Yes, I thought, it was true. I lost my breath then, like I'd run naked into the cold waves of Lake Michigan once more. I was grateful to be alive, even with trash floating past. I was grateful to have Shoddy here. I was grateful to have read the letters from Dad, and I was grateful to have moved in next door to Augustus Everett. Whatever came next, I could survive it all, like Shoddy had so many times. By the time I realized all this, a full minute must have passed without another knock on the door, or any more shouts, and my heart raced as I hurried toward the door, Shoddy clapping from the couch as if she were watching an Olympic race from the stands. I threw the door open to the dark, stormy porch, but it was empty. I ran out, barefoot, to the steps and scoured the yard, the street below, the steps next door. Gus was nowhere in sight. I jogged down the steps recklessly, and halfway down, cut through the grass instead, toes squelching in the mud. I had reached Gus's front yard when it hit me. His car wasn't here. He was gone. I'd missed him. I wasn't sure whether I'd started to cry again or if all my tears had been used up. My ribs ached. Everything within them hurt. My shoulders were shaking and my face was wet, but that might have been from the downpour blanketing our little beach street. The whole thing was flooded now, a current carrying leaves and bits of trash away in a rush. I wanted to scream. I'd been so patient with Gus all summer. I'd told him I would be, and I had been, and now I had closed back up in what was likely our last chance moment. I buried the back of my hand against my mouth as a ragged sob worked its way out of my chest. I wanted to collapse into the marshy grass, be absorbed into it. If I were the ground, I thought, I'd feel even less than I did when I was cleaning. Or maybe I'd feel every step, every footprint walking over me, but that still might be better than the desolation I felt now. Because I knew again, for certain, that Shoddy had been right. I'd finally fallen. It had been impossibly fortuitous, fated, for me to find myself crossing paths with someone I could love like Gus Everett, and I still felt lucky, even as I felt miserable. A light flicked on in the corner of my vision, and I turned toward it, expecting to find Shoddy on the front porch. But the light wasn't coming from my front porch. It was coming from Gus's. And then the music started, as loud as it had been that first night, like Pitchfork or Bonnaroo was unfolding right here on our cul-de-sac. Sinead O'Connor's voice rang out, the mournful opening lines of "Nothing Compares to You." The door opened, and he stepped out under the light, as soaked as I was, though somehow, against all odds, his peppered, wavy hair still managed to defy gravity, sticking up at odd, sleepy angles. With the song still ringing out into the street, interrupted only by the occasional distant rattle of the retreating storm, Gus came toward me in the rain. He looked as unsure whether he should laugh or cry as I now felt, and when he reached me, he tried to say something, only to realize the song was too loud for him to speak in a normal voice. I was shaking and my teeth were chattering, but I didn't feel cold exactly. I felt more like I was standing just a ways outside my body.
"I didn't plan this well at all,"
Gus finally shouted over the music, jerking his chin toward his house meaningfully. A smile flickered over my face, even as a pang went through my abdomen.
"I thought..."
He ran his hand up through his hair and glanced around.
"I don't know. I thought maybe we'd dance."
A laugh leapt out of me, surprising us both, and Gus's face brightened at the sound. As soon as its last trace had faded, tears sprang back into my eyes, a burning starting at the back of my nose.
"You were going to dance with me in the rain?"
I asked thickly.
"I promised you,"
he said seriously, taking my waist in his hands.
"I said I would learn."
I shook my head and fought to steady my voice.
"You're not beholden to any promises, Gus."
Slowly, he pulled me against him and wrapped his arms around me, the heat of him only slightly dimmed by the chill of the rain.
"It's not the promise that matters,"
he murmured just above my right ear as he started to sway, rocking me side to side in a tender approximation of a dance, the inverse of that night we'd spent at the frat party.
It's that I told you.
Soft January. January who could never hide what she was thinking. January who he'd always been afraid to break. My throat knotted. It almost hurt being held by him like this, not knowing what he was about to tell me, or whether this would be the last time he held me at all. I tried to say something, to again insist he wasn't obligated to me, that I understood the complicated state of things. I couldn't make a sound. His hand was in my damp hair, and I closed my eyes against another stream of tears, burying my face in his wet shoulder.
I thought you were gone. Your car...
I trailed off.
Is stuck on the side of the road right now,
he said.
It's raining like the world is ending.
He gave a forced smile, but I couldn't match it. The song had ended, but we were still rocking, holding on to each other, and I was terrified of the moment he'd let go, all while trying to appreciate this instant, the one when he still hadn't.
I've been calling you,
he said. And I nodded because I couldn't get out, I know. I sucked a breath into my lungs and asked,
was that Naomi?
I didn't clarify that I meant the beautiful woman at the event, but I didn't need to.
Yeah,
Gus answered in a hush. For a few more seconds, neither of us spoke.
She wanted to talk,
he finally offered.
We went for a drink next door.
I am still standing, I thought. Well, not quite. I was leaning, letting him take the bulk of my weight, but I was alive, and Shoddy was inside waiting for me. I would be okay.
She wants to get back together,
I choked out. I'd meant it as a question, but it came out more proclamation. Gus eased back enough to look into my eyes, but I didn't reciprocate. I kept my cheek pressed into his chest.
I guess she and Parker split up a while ago,
Gus said, resting his chin on my head again. His arms tightened across my back.
She said she'd been thinking about it for a long time, but she wanted to wait, to make sure I wasn't her rebound.
How could you be her rebound? I asked. You're her husband.
His gruff laugh rumbled through me.
I said something like that.
My stomach squirmed.
She's not a bad person,
Gus said, like he was pleading with me. My gut twisted.
Glad to hear it.
Really?
Gus asked, head tilting.
Why?
You shouldn't be married to an asshole, I guess. Probably no one should, except maybe other assholes.
Well, that's the thing,
he said quietly.
She asked me if I could ever forgive her. And I think I could. I mean, eventually.
I said nothing.
And then she asked if I could see myself being with her again, and I can imagine it. I think it's possible.
I thought maybe I should say something. Oh? Good? Well then? The pain didn't seem content to have been heard. It roared up in me.
Gus,
I whispered, and closed my eyes as more hot tears streamed out of them. I shook my head.
She asked if we could make our marriage work,
he murmured, and my arms went limp. I stepped back from him, wiping at my face as I put distance between us. I stared at the flooded grass and my muddy toes.
I never expected to hear her say that,
Gus said breathlessly.
And I don't know, I needed time to figure it all out, so I went home and I just started to think it all through. And I wanted to call you, but it seemed so selfish to call you like that and make you help me figure it out. So I just spent all day yesterday thinking about it,
he said.
And at first I thought...
He stopped again and shook his head sort of manically.
I could definitely be with Naomi again, but even if we could be together, I didn't think I could ever be married again. It was all too messy and painful. And then I thought about that more and realized I didn't mean it.
I tightened my eyes as more tears pushed out. Please, I wanted to beg him, stop. but I felt stuck in my own body, held prisoner there.
"January," he said softly. "Look at me." I shook my head.
I listened to his steps moving through the grass. He slipped my lifeless hands into his.
"What I meant is, I did mean it about her and me. I didn't mean it about you."
I opened my eyes and looked up into his face, blurred behind my tears. His throat shifted, jaw flexed.
"I've never met someone who is so perfectly my favorite person. When I think about being with you every day, no part of me feels claustrophobic. And when I think about having to have the kinds of fights with you that Naomi and I used to have, there's nothing scary about it, because I trust you more than I've ever trusted anyone, even Pete. When I think about you, January, and I think about doing laundry with you and trying terrible green juice cleanses and going to antique malls with you, I only feel happy. The world looks different than I ever thought it could be, and I don't want to look for what's broken or what could go wrong. I don't want to brace myself for the worst and miss out on being with you. I want to be the one who gives you what you deserve, and I want to sleep next to you every night, and to be the one you complain about book stuff to, and I don't think I ever could deserve any of that, and I know this thing between us isn't a sure thing, but that's what I want to aim for with you. Because I know no matter how long I get to love you, it will be worth whatever comes after."
It was so close to the same thought I'd had earlier tonight, and before that, as we drove back from New Eden, our hands clutching each other against the gear shift. But now it sounded different, felt a little sour in my stomach.
"It will be worth it,"
he said again, more quietly, more urgently.
"You can't know that,"
I whispered. I stepped back from him slowly, swiping the tears from my eyes.
"Fine," Gus murmured. "I can't know it, but I believe it. I see it. Let me prove I'm right. Let me prove I can love you forever."
My voice came out thin and weak.
"We're both wrecks. It's not just you. I wanted to think it was, but it's not. I'm a disaster. I feel like I need to relearn everything, especially how to be in love. Where would we even start?"
Gus pulled my hands away from my tear-streaked face. His smile was faint, but even in the cloudy light of morning, I could see the dimple creasing his cheek. His hands skated onto my hips, and he pulled me softly against him, tucking his chin on my head.
"Here,"
he whispered into my hair. My heart skipped a beat. Was that possible? I wanted it so badly, wanted him in every part of my life, just like he'd said.
"When I watch you sleep," he said shakily, "I feel overwhelmed that you exist."
The tears rushed full force into my eyes again.
"What if we don't get a happy ending, Gus?"
I whispered. He thought it over, his hands still sliding and tightening and pushing against me like they couldn't sit still. His dark eyes homed in on mine. As I looked up at him, his gaze was doing the sexy, evil thing. But now, it seemed less sexy evil and more just Gus.
"Then maybe we should enjoy our happy for now,"
Gus said.
"Happy for now."
I tasted the words, rolled them over the back of my tongue like wine. The only promise you ever had in life was the one moment you were living. And I was. Happy for now. I could live with that. I could learn to live with that. Slowly, he began to sway me back and forth again. I wrapped my arms around his neck and let his circle my waist, and we stood there, learning to dance in the rain. Chapter 28. 9 months later.
"Ready?" Gus said.
I clutched the advance copy of The Great Family Marconi against my chest. I suspected I would never be ready. Not for this book, and not for him. Handing it over to the world was going to feel like falling headfirst out of an airplane, and I could only hope that something below decided to rise up and catch me. I asked Gus, "Are you?" His head tilted as he considered, He had just reached the line edits phase of editing his book, so his manuscript was held together by binder clips, rather than the cheapo paperback binding used for the advance copies. In the end, my book had sold 3 weeks before his, but his had sold for a little more money, and both of us had decided to ditch the pen names. We'd written books we were proud of, and even if they were different from what we usually did, they were still ours. It was strange not to see the little sun over waves, Sandy Lowe's logo on the spine where it had been for all my other books. But I knew my next book, Curmudgeon, was going to have it, and that felt good. Curmudgeon, my readers would love. I loved it too. No more or less than I loved Family Marconi, but perhaps I felt more protective of the Marconis than I did my other protagonists, because I didn't know how they'd be judged. Anya had insisted that anyone who didn't want to swaddle the Marconis in the softest silk and hand-feed them grapes is just swine with no need for pearls. Don't you worry. Of course, she'd said that when forwarding the first trade review this morning, which had been largely positive, apart from describing the cast as unwieldy and Eleanor herself as rather shrill.
"I think I am," Gus answered, and handed his stack of pages to me.
He had no reason to worry, and I told myself I didn't either. In the past year, I'd read both of his books, and he'd already read all three of mine, and so far, each other's writing hadn't left either of us repulsed by the other. In fact, reading The Revelatories had felt a bit like swimming through Gus's mind. It was heartbreaking and beautiful, but very, very funny in some moments, and extremely odd in many. I passed him my book, and he grinned down at the illustrated cover, the stripes of the tent swooping down into curls at the bottom, tying knots around the silhouetted figures of the characters, binding them together.
"It's a good day," Gus said.
Sometimes he said that, usually when we were in the middle of something mundane, like loading the dishwasher or dusting the front room of his house in our nasty cleaning clothes. Since selling Dad's house in February, I'd spent a lot of time in the beach house next door, but Gus came to my apartment in town, too. It was over the music store, and during the day, while we were working in my breakfast nook, we could hear stray college students stopping by to test out drum sets they could never have fit in their dorms. Even when it bothered us, it was something we shared. Truthfully, sometimes Gus and I liked to be grumps together. At night, after the shop closed, the owners, a middle-aged brother and sister with matching bone gauges in their ears, always turned their music up. Dylan or Neil Young and Crazy Horse or the Rolling Stones, and sat on their back stoop, smoking one shared joint. Gus and I would sit on my tiny balcony above them and let the smells and sounds float up to us.
"It's a good day," he'd say.
Or if he'd accidentally shut the balcony door with it locked again, he'd say something like,
"What a fucking day."
And then he'd climb down the fire escape to the weed-smoking siblings and ask if he could cut through the store to the second stairwell inside the building, and they'd say, "Sure, man," and a minute later, he'd appear behind me with a fresh beer in hand. Sometimes I missed the kitchen in the old house, that hand-painted white and blue tile, but these past few weeks, as summer began anew, I'd heard the clamor and laughter of the six-person family that was staying in it, and I imagined they appreciated the touch as much as I ever had. Maybe someday, one of the four kids would describe those careful designs to his own children, a piece of memory that managed to stay bright as everything else grew vague and fuzzy. "It is a good day," I agreed. Tomorrow was the anniversary of the day Naomi left Gus, the night of his 33rd birthday, and he'd finally told Markham he'd prefer not to have the big party.
"I just want to sit on the beach and read," he'd said.
So that had been our plan for the last 2 weeks. We would finally swap our latest books and read them outside. I was, of course, surprised he'd suggested it. While we both loved the view, I'd seen in the last year that Gus wasn't lying about how little time he spent on the beach. He thought it was too crowded during the day, and at night it was too cold to swim anyway. We'd spent much more time down there in January and February, walking out along the frozen waves, holding our arms out as we stood on the edge of the world, squinting into the dying light, our jackets rippling. The lake froze so far out that we could even walk on it past the lighthouse my father had once ridden his tricycle into. And what was more, the water froze so high, and the snow piled on top of it such that we could walk right up to the top of the lighthouse, stand on it like it was part of some lost civilization underneath us, Gus's arm hooked around my neck as he hummed, "It's June in January because I'm in love." I'd had to buy a bigger coat, one that looked like a sleeping bag with arms, a fur-lined hood, and rings of down-stuffed Gore-Tex all the way to my ankles, and still I sometimes had to layer sweatshirts and long-sleeved t-shirts under it. But the sun? Fuck, the sun was brilliant on those winter days, glancing off every crystal edge sharper than when it had first hit. It was like being on another planet, just Gus and me, closer to a star than we'd ever been. Our faces would go so numb we couldn't feel the snot dripping down them, and when we got back inside, our fingers would be purple, gloves or no, and our cheeks would be flushed, and we'd flick on the gas fireplace and collapse onto the couch, shivering and chattering and too numb to undress and tangle up beneath blankets with any semblance of grace.
"January, January," Gus would sing, his teeth clacking from the cold. "Even if there aren't any snowflakes, we'll have January all year long."
I had never liked winter before, but now I understood. Sitting on a blanket on the sand tonight was nice, but we were sharing the sparkling waves with 36 other people. It was a different kind of beauty, hearing shrieks and squeals rise between the crashing of water on shore, more like those nights I'd sat out in my parents' backyard listening to the neighbor kids chasing fireflies. I was glad Gus was giving it all a try. We read for a couple of hours, then staggered home in the dark. I slept at his house that night, and when I woke, he was already out of bed, the burble of the coffee pot coming from the kitchen. We went back to the beach that afternoon and sat side by side, reading each other's books again. I wondered what he would think of the ending to mine, whether it would feel too contrived to him, or if he'd be disappointed I hadn't truly committed to an unhappy ending. But his book was shorter, and I finished first, with a burst of laughter that made him look up, startled, from the page.
"What?" he asked.
I shook my head.
"I'll tell you when you're done."
I lay on the sand and stared up into the lavender sky. The sun had started setting, and we'd long since eaten our snacks. My stomach growled. I stifled another laugh. Gus's new book, tentatively titled The Cup Is Already Broken, was nothing close to a rom-com, although it did have a strong romantic thread woven into the plot and had come extremely close to a happy ending. The protagonist, Travis, had left the cult with all the evidence he needed. He'd even talked Doris into leaving with him. They were happy, extremely happy, but for no more than a page or two before the world-ending meteor the prophet had been predicting hit the Earth. The world hadn't ended. In fact, Travis and Doris were the only two human casualties. It had missed the compound and hit the woods just off the road the two were traveling on. It hadn't even been the meteor to kill them. It had been the distraction of it, Travis's eyes skirting off the road he'd worked so hard to get onto. The right tire had run off the shoulder, and when he'd cranked it back too hard, he'd hit a semi-truck that was flying past in the other direction, come to a screaming halt, crumpled like a stomped-on can. I closed my eyes against the dusky sky and swallowed my laughter down. I didn't know why I couldn't stop, but soon the feeling hardened in my belly, and I realized I wasn't laughing. I was crying. I felt both defeated and understood. Angry that these characters had deserved better than they'd gotten, and somehow comforted by their experience. Yes, I thought, that is how life feels too often. Like you're doing everything you can to survive, only to be sabotaged by something beyond your control, maybe even some darker part of yourself. Sometimes it was your body, your cells turning into poison and fighting against you, or chronic pain sprouting up your neck and wrapping around the outsides of your scalp until it felt like fingernails sinking into your brain. Sometimes it was lust, or heartbreak, or loneliness, or fear driving you off the road toward something you'd spent months or years avoiding, actively fighting against. At least the last thing they'd seen, the meteor streaming toward Earth, had distracted them because of its beauty. They hadn't been afraid, they'd been mesmerized. Maybe that was all you could hope for in life. I didn't know how long I'd been lying there, tears trickling quietly down my cheeks, but I felt a rough thumb catch one and opened my eyes to Gus's gentle face. The sky had darkened to a brutal blue. Seeing that color on someone's skin would make your stomach turn. It was gorgeous in this context. Strange how things could be repellent in some situations and incredible in others.
"Hey," he said tenderly. "What's wrong?"
I sat up and wiped my face dry. "So much for your happy ending," I said. Gus's brow furrowed.
"It was a happy ending."
"For who?"
"For them," he said. "They were happy. They had no regrets. They'd won, and they didn't even have to see it coming. For all we know, they live in that moment forever, happy like that, together and free."
Chills crawled down my arms. I knew what he meant. I'd always felt grateful Dad had gone in his sleep. I hoped the night before he and Mom had watched something on TV that made him laugh so hard he had to take off his glasses and get the tears out of his eyes. Maybe something with a boat in it. I hoped he'd had a few too many of Mom's infamous martinis to feel any worry when he crawled into bed, apart from that he might not feel so hot in the morning. I had told Mom this when I'd gone home to visit at Christmas. She had cried and held me close. "It was something like that," she promised. "So much of our lives were something like that." Talking about him came in fits and starts. I learned not to press it. She learned to let it out bit by bit, and that sometimes it was okay to let a little ugliness into your story, that it would never rob you of all the beauty.
"It's a happy ending,"
Gus said again, bringing me back to the beach.
"Besides, what about your ending? Everything tied up perfectly."
"Hardly," I said. "The only boy Eleanor had even thought she'd loved is married now."
"Yeah, and she and Nick are obviously going to get together," Gus said. "You could sense that through the whole book. It was obvious he was in love with her and that she loved him back."
I rolled my eyes. "I think you're projecting."
"Maybe so," he said, smiling back at me. "I guess we both failed," I said, climbing to my feet.
Gus followed me. We started up the crooked, rooty path.
"I don't think so. I think I wrote my version of a happy ending, and you wrote your version of a sad one. We had to write what we think is true."
"And you still believe a meteor hitting the Earth is the best-case scenario in a romance?" Gus laughed. We'd forgotten to leave the porch light on, but there was nothing to trip over. He'd never had porch furniture, and when I'd given Dad's to Sonia, we'd decided to save up and get our own, then promptly forgotten. Gus finally got the key into the lock, then stopped to face me in the dark before turning it. His hand found the side of my face, and his warm mouth pressed into mine. When he pulled back, my hair catching in his scruff, he said quietly,
"If I were hit by a meteor while in the car with you, yes, I would still think I went out on a high note."
My cheeks still heated when he said things like that. The lava-like feeling still filled my stomach. He opened the door and took my hand as we stepped inside. He set the manuscripts on the shoe rack beside the door before reaching to flick the light on, and a chorus of voices rose up, crying, "Surprise!" I balked in confusion. Pete and Maggie and Mom, with her new wavy bob and the Everlane linen pants she wore whenever she traveled, Shoddy and her newish boyfriend, sexy Louisiana werewolf, now deeply invested enough in her life that we usually referred to him as Armand, his actual name, and Kayla Markham were standing in the study, all grinning like an orthodontist billboard, holding glasses of champagne, and perhaps more puzzlingly, dressed vaguely like pirates. A A tinsel-laden banner hung over the doorway behind them, colorful letters spelling out, "Happy Anniversary." As far as grand gestures went, this was the strangest I'd ever seen. "What?" I said, not sure where to go from there. "This is... what?" Gus was standing beside me, and when I looked up at him, his crooked mouth rose in one corner.
"I have a good idea, January,"
he said. And then his face was lowering as he knelt in front of me. My hand was in his, and I realized I was shaking, or he was shaking, or we both were. He gazed up at me in the warm light of the study. My voice came out small and tinny.
"Another Pirates of the Caribbean movie?"
His smile split wide and full, so open that if I leaned forward, I thought I could look down his throat straight at his beating heart.
"January Andrews, a year ago I met you for the second time, and it's changed my life. I don't care how it ends, as long as I spend it all with you."
He reached into his pocket and pulled out a small white square, a crinkled piece of notebook paper that looked like it had been creased and unfurled hundreds of times already. Slowly, he unfolded it once more and held it up to me, revealing the two words sprawled across it in large black letters. "Marry me." Maybe I should have taken the time to write back. Instead, I grabbed and kissed him. I said into his mouth, "Yes," and then again, "Yes, yes." Pete and Maggie whooped, Mom clapped, Shoddy flung herself forward to hug me. In books, I'd always felt like the happily ever after appeared as a new beginning. But for me, it didn't feel like that. My happily ever after was a strand of strung together, happy for nows, extending back not just to a year ago, but to 30 years before. Mine had already begun, and so this day was neither an ending nor a beginning. It was just another good day, a perfect day. A happy for now so vast and deep that I knew, or rather believed, I didn't have to worry about tomorrow. Reader's Guide. Behind the Book. I have a friend who thinks The Shining movie is hilarious. She says she can't watch it without laughing. Her favorite part is when Shelley Duvall finds the manuscript Jack Nicholson has been working on all winter, only to realize every page is the same sentence, typed over and over again. It's a chilling moment in the movie as the character realizes the mental state of her husband. But to my friend, it's also a perfect punchline. "It's a whole movie about writer's block," she tells me. If the funniest things are supposed to be a little bit true, then yes, this is a hilarious moment. Because when you're working on something as expansive as a book, there are a whole lot of moments when you stop seeing the work clearly, when you have no idea what you're doing, when you're pretty sure all those great ideas you had before you started were actually garbage. There are moments in which you might not be that surprised to look down and realize you've written "all work and no play" 2 billion times. There are times when your whole apartment can start to feel vaguely haunted, like the viney wallpaper in the hallway is a manifestation of the plot tangles you can't seem to work through, and it's coming to life, slowly tightening around you. And there is a kind of twisted humor to the idea that maybe this whole horror movie really is just about how lonely, confusing, and maddening writing a book can be. When friends ask me what Beach Read is about, I tell them it's about a disillusioned romance author and a literary fiction writer who make a deal to swap genres for the summer. When other writers ask me what Beach Read is about, I tell them it's about writer's block. The summer I wrote Beach Read, I was feeling absolutely sapped of energy and inspiration. I felt like I had nothing left to say, no new characters drifting around my brain, no story I was desperate to tell. And yet, the sudden change to warm weather had me itching to write. Every season this happens, the way the smells and colors of nature transform, the way the air itself feels a little different, always makes me want to create. I tried Netflix binging. I tried sinking into some fizzy, light, summery reading, tried talking myself into doing some yoga or walking the dog. I did a lot of unproductive pacing and some lying in various positions on the floor. But all I wanted to do was work, which wouldn't have been a problem if I'd had an idea for a book. No matter how I strained my mind, brainstormed, Googled stupid things like what should I write about, I couldn't find a single kernel of inspiration. And so obviously, the only thing I could write about was not being able to write. It didn't sound like a good idea to me. It definitely didn't sound like something that would turn into a real book, but it was all I had. So I started writing about an author with writer's block. And I thought back to every time I was stuck, every season when the words just wouldn't come out and the plots wouldn't untangle themselves, and I thought about all the different reasons we get stuck, creatively and otherwise. The things that come up in life that make it very hard to do the things we care about. The crises that make us question whether we really do care about those things, or if it's okay to still care about them when the whole world seems to be falling apart around us. I interrogated my writer's block. I asked how it connected to all the other parts of my life, and the ways in which it seemed dissonant from the rest of my life. And the more curious I became, the more inspiration found its way to me. January grew far outside of me until she was a full, real character, a thorny, messy, heartbroken woman with a lush, meaningful story. She became a romance writer, which at the time I didn't consider myself to be. My questions shifted. What would make it hard for her to write? What would have to happen to make her doubt she could ever write again? How is her writer's block connected to what's going on in the rest of her life? What would it take to make her fight for herself and what she wants again? Sometimes we lose the ability to create simply because we're tired. We need to rest and recover. But other times, we can't move forward because there are hard questions we have to ask first, hurdles in our path we first have to jump, or walls that need breaking down, interrogations demanding to be made. And when we're brave enough to do so, we can make something beautiful, something we didn't know we were capable of before we began. So, yes, sometimes making art is a horror story. But other times, you fall head over heels in love. Either way, you'll probably laugh. This is Julia Whalen. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Beach Read by Emily Henry. This program was directed by Christina Rooney. Executive producer, Kelly Gilday. Text copyright 2020 by Emily Henry. Production copyright 2020, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.